Two Truths and a Lie. Here is an addition to the category of odd but true anatomy division. It is a third human nipple, a vestige of our evolution from large litters to the current format of single gestations followed by prolonged parenting. About 5% of humans will have a third nipple, located somewhere along the ancestral milk line, extending from the armpit to the groin. This extra body part is not a perky or responsive thing, really just an odd little nubbin that is often mistaken for a mole. However, it's enough to fire the imagination. In the Salem witch trials, a third nipple was considered evidence that a woman had suckled the devil. In the movie The Man with the Golden Gun, James Bond identified the villain Scaramanga on the basis of his third nipple. The Triple Nipple Club also includes such celebrities as Zac Efron, Mark Wahlberg, Tilda Swinton, and the character Chandler Bing from the TV show Friends. It was just these fun facts that made me think that a third nipple would be the perfect lie for the party game Two Truths and a Lie. Every Thanksgiving, Nick and I host a multi-generational group of family and friends at our house, usually from 30 to 40 people with ages ranging from toddler to 85. I always concoct a game or gimmick so that people don't start the afternoon by auto-segregating into football for the men, videos for the kids, and food prep for the women. One year, everyone had to write a haiku poem on cloth prayer flags that we then strung around the room. Another year, I set up a photo booth complete with different costumes. This year, it was Two Truths and a Lie. The idea is to come up with two quirky truths about yourself and one believable lie. Much discussion and frivolity ensues as a group tries to identify the lie. Nick and daughter Frances absolutely nixed the third nipple, firmly stating that anything to do with nipples would be inappropriate for a woman. "But it's a lie," I said. "It's not like I'd be called on for a demo." They countered with the argument that it was just too weird to encourage family members to contemplate what was going on under my shirt. Okay, I could see their point, but I didn't think such restrictions would apply to a man's nipples. In the Friends episode, the cast members were utterly titillated by the thought that Chandler Bing was triply endowed, and I wanted to create the same excitement for our Thanksgiving group. I urged Nick to adopt my lie, but he demurred, opting instead for a physical oddity that had no sexual overtones. He wrote down that his toes were webbed. I yawned. I pondered alternative lies that would create the same excitement as I began to set up the house, bringing in folding chairs from the garage and basement and setting two tables in the kitchen and two in the dining room. We were expecting 38, but I wanted to set a few extra places for last-minute additions. Family members often show up with friends or neighbors stranded by a canceled flight or a broken-down car. I tried to conjure up other fictitious oddities, such as a pattern of moles on my back in the shape of the Liberty Bell, including the crack, or the ability to burp the entire Lord's Prayer, but none seemed to have the same panache as a third nipple. As I squeezed and grated the rind of 10 limes for a mascarpone pie, I recalled one of the last times I had played the game. It was a company team-building event and one of the first times I had met my colleague Doris Mueller. In my capacity as a medical consultant for a health plan, I had talked with Doris, a nurse, on almost a weekly basis as she sought my advice on whether or not requests for insurance coverage were legitimate or just a smokescreen for cosmetic procedures. "Hello, Dr. Brown. This is Doris Mueller," she said, stretching out her name with a downward slide, sounding like the melancholy of an unmilked cow. "How are you?" This was in the era before caller ID, so it was difficult to dodge her calls. I would wince as she launched into the minutiae of a case. A man who wanted his health insurance to pay for growth hormone so that he would be taller than his father. "Yes, Doris, that is cosmetic." Or a request for Botox for headaches that sounded suspiciously like a ploy for wrinkle removal. "Maybe, Doris, but ask for doctor's office notes to confirm the headaches." Heavy gloom dripped from each of her sentences. Every time she called, I tried to invent some new chipper response, all to no avail. "Oh, Doris, I know that it's raining, but the drops on my window are trembling and shimmering. It's so beautiful. Oh, Doris, you wouldn't believe the fabulous pen I found today. It's the kind that never smears or streaks, and I was so lucky to spot it on the sidewalk. Oh, Doris, aren't you glad that it's Tuesday instead of Monday?" "Oh, yes, Dr. Brown, that sounds nice," she would say, followed by a heaving sigh. After a year of a purely telephone relationship, I finally met her in person at an all-team meeting. Doris Mueller was as gloomy in person as she sounded on the phone. She was pasty and overweight in the soft and lumpy way of people who rarely exercise. Her hair was that washed-out blonde color that women use as they transition to gray, but the finely etched part across her thinning scalp revealed a strip of dark roots. These features could describe many women who have spent too many years in a windowless cubicle, but the most striking aspect of her appearance was her lifeless eyes. I saw no joy, no imagination, no verve. "Doris," I shrieked in feigned delight, "I'm so happy to meet you after all the hours we spent on the phone. How are you?" "Hi, Dr. Brown, it's Doris Mueller. Nice to meet you." Her tone was flat and her hand hung limp in mine. Our group immediately segued into two truths and a lie. Similar to my Thanksgiving role, I was part of the management team at this event and felt some responsibility to set the tone, so I decided to create a conversation starter with my lie. I wrote, "I once played spin the bottle with Prince Charles when I was an exchange student at Cambridge." I didn't think it was totally out of the realm of possibility. We were about the same age, after all. But my lie provoked little interest and no lively brush with greatness conversation. My attempt at levity with Prince Charles seemed tame, paltry, and a bit snobby. It just didn't work. We then moved to Doris's trio of entries, one of which was, "I attended Woodstock." How could this down-in-the-dumps woman ever have been a free spirit who attended Woodstock? But even as a lie, it was so wonderfully creative, ideally fulfilling the purpose of the game by promoting discussion of the 1960s in general, favorite bands, and other tales of misspent youth. I saw a documentary on Woodstock, and the reporter actually found the couple with the soggy sleeping bags who were on the album cover. Now they're mostly worried about health benefits. "Do you remember Alan Fay? On the Woodstock album, they announced his name and said, 'Alan Fay, come to the tent, please. It's a bummer, man.' I've always wanted to know more about Alan Fay and his bummer." "That reminds me of all the great 1960s jargon. When was the last time you said, 'Righteous Babe,' or 'Cheez It, the Fuzz'?" On and on it went, and then the big reveal. "It's true. I was at Woodstock," Doris said as she shrugged her shoulders. In the time it took to say the four words, "I was at Woodstock," my whole perception of Doris changed. I swept away the dowdiness and imagined a mud-streaked Doris reveling in the music and dancing the dance of joy. I was jealous. This was just the type of free-spirited adventure that I wished I could lay claim to, though I knew it's never been in my nature to be so impulsive on a grand scale. Not at age 17 when Woodstock kicked off, and not now, 45 years later. I snapped out of my daydream as I stacked the pies into the overstuffed refrigerator. Nick was now at the counter massaging a huge wad of stuffing, more than enough for the 20-pound turkey headed for the oven, and the second bird destined for the barbecue grill by the back door. "I was just thinking," I said, "could someone change people's perception with just one truth or lie? Maybe use this game as a way to shake things up or test out a new identity?" "What do you mean?" he said. "So you think that two truths and a lie would be an appropriate venue to announce an engagement, a pregnancy, or some other life event?" I could tell he was getting enthused by the idea as he vigorously added celery to the stuffing. Bread croutons were now spilling over the sides and falling on the floor. The dogs had caught on and hovered at her feet. Okay, obviously I was thinking of something subtler. I then told him the story of Doris and how her Woodstock truth had totally changed my perception of her. Unfortunately, I never did find out what happened to Doris. I left the company shortly after her big reveal and we went our separate ways, but I was consoled by the thought that whatever bummer befell Doris, she would always have her one defining moment at Woodstock. "So what kind of perception about yourself would you possibly want to change?" Nick asked. "Your Doris might have needed some moment of excitement that she could cling to as her life turned sour. What makes you think you need a defining moment?" He went outside to check the garden to see if there were any Brussels sprouts that he could harvest for the stuffing. The rich smell of turkey was now permeating the house. It was time to work on the seating arrangements. I made a list of pairs of things like Bert and Ernie, or peanut butter and jelly. I put each half of the pair in a hat. Each person would draw from the hat and then find their dinner partner by searching for their matching self. One year people had to find the matching pair of an oxymoron. Jumbo sat with shrimp. Pretty sat with ugly, and butt and head were dinner partners. Family members were starting to arrive bearing creamy clam dip and thick chips, cranberry chutney that absolutely glistened in its bowl on the counter, loaves of the pumpkin tea bread that had become a tradition, and a medley of other casseroles and salads. Grandnieces and nephews were racing around trying to grab the dog's tail. Others were playing catch with the beanbag animals I had spread around the living room. People congregated around the card table set up with pencils and post-it notes to write their truths and lies and stick them on the kitchen wall. There was much chatter and discussion, and I realized that many had put quite a bit of thought into the exercise. The wall slowly filled with truths and lies, some in the tentative handwriting of the youngest, and others in the equally tentative handwriting of the oldest. Nick arrived with the turkey from outside. "Have you figured out your truths and lies yet?" he asked. "I don't want you to overthink this. You do realize this is just a parlor game that is supposed to provide some laughs." I slowly began to carve the turkey, taking a little corner of the crispy skin and toasted stuffing for myself. I hoped that Doris Mueller wasn't spending her Thanksgiving alone in a country buffet, picking at hours-old stringy turkey and daydreaming about her moment of glory at Woodstock. I thought about my good fortune when someone tapped me on the shoulder and asked me for a whisk to get lumps out of the gravy. This was just a small moment, one of the many that coalesced into the maelstrom of Thanksgiving that now defined me. I quickly scribbled down some truths and lies in the spirit of the game. Nothing special, nothing deep, that I used Botox for wrinkles, that I had experienced an earthquake in a waterbed, and that I've never eaten an olive. When my post-it note was read, the group easily identified my Botox lie based on my unadorned face. But then there was much discussion and laughter about my aversion to olives and my iconic California experience in a sloshing waterbed atop a trembling earth. Mission accomplished. The next post-it note should not have been that surprising, given that we were a group of over 30 and the incidence is 1 in 20. It's just that people are rarely given such a golden opportunity for a public display. "Look at this," someone said. "Drew says that he has a third nipple." Excitement shot through the room, and I passed a knowing look of smugness to Nick and Francis. In a scene reminiscent of Friends, people crowded around my brother-in-law and asked for a demo. The last piece of my Thanksgiving tableau fell into place as Drew lifted up the corner of his shirt.